Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Exceptional Educator. My name is Ross Morey, and I'm the co-founder of BayTreeBlog.com, and I'm also Anne Marie's very lucky spouse. Today, we have got an awesome show for you guys. Anne Marie interviews a good friend and talented colleague, Diana Kennedy. Diana is an educational therapist. She works with students of all ages and abilities, and her specialty is helping students who struggle to regulate their own emotions, which for anybody who's worked closely with students one-on-one or in the classroom, we know this is a big deal. It means the difference between making it through the day's lesson and having a total meltdown. Diana has trained in all of the top methods for teaching students who learn differently: Orton Gillingham, Linda Mabel, Making Math Real, you name it, she's studied it. Diana brings years of teaching experience to the table, and she's able to really give us some actionable advice and some tools that we can put to use right away for helping students who struggle with these emotional regulation challenges. In this interview, Anne-Marie and Diana discuss how to validate a student's perspective without brushing off their feelings, the importance of storytelling, and helping students to name their own emotions. What do you do when a child melts down completely? And how to use simple mindfulness practices in your work with students. All right, guys, let's get to it. Here's Anne-Marie and Diana.
So Diana, tell me how you got started as an educational therapist.
Okay, well, I was a classroom teacher, and I actually started out as a classroom teacher in Mississippi doing Teach for America, where this was a long time ago. They hadn't really moved forward on their training. So we had 5 weeks of training, and I felt very overwhelmed.
And were you high schoolers. This is right after you graduated from college?
Well, I had gotten a master's degree in English literature, thinking I wanted to be a professor, and then changed my mind. I'd worked with kids at camps, I had worked with kids teaching religious school, but I had never taught.
Right.
So here I was going into, like, some of the most difficult, you know, one of the most difficult schools, difficult areas in the country, rural Mississippi. And I had one kid in particular named Floyd, who was my 18-year-old freshman. And he had flunked and flunked and flunked. And I was teaching him English, and so that's the gateway class. Your grade level at that school was which English are you in. And he had, I would estimate, probably a third or fourth grade reading level. And I tried my very best to help him, but I didn't know what I was doing, really. So I'd read a paragraph and have him read a paragraph and ask him a question and have him ask me a question. But I didn't know anything about phonemic awareness. I didn't know any of that. And because I was teaching high school, so nobody taught me that. And this was pre-Google, so I couldn't go, how to teach reading? So at the end of the 2 years, I thought, I want to keep working with kids, but I want to know what I'm doing, and I want to work with younger kids, because I figured if someone had gotten to Floyd when he was in first, second, or third grade, he wouldn't have made it to high school with a fourth grade reading level.
Absolutely. So you decided, so when you came back to California, you wanted to work with younger students so you could really understand what was going on, getting in the way of their success, and sort of jump right in when it really mattered.
Yes, exactly. And so I also wanted to go to the most opposite place of Mississippi possible. So I went to Berkeley, which qualified. So I got a master's degree in elementary education. But then when I got into the classes, I still felt like I didn't quite know what to do with kids who were struggling. You know, they had given us a class, but it was more like, leave white space on the page and don't make anyone feel terrible about themselves. But it wasn't, you know, Linda Mabel, or it wasn't, you know, Orton Gillingham.
Right. So it's like you never got to, like, the really meaty stuff for what your students needed.
Right. And so each year, I would have sort of a cluster of kids who needed something, and that year, that's what I would take classes on. So my first year, I was like, holy moly, do I have kids with ADD. And I can recognize it because they're falling out of their seats, and they're, you know, they can't sit still, but I have no idea what to do about it. So I took some classes on that and learned some techniques to help them. And then the next year I had probably two or three kids who just clearly had some level of dyslexia. And again, I didn't know what to do about it, so I started taking classes on dyslexia. And that summer I took like a 40-hour training on Orton-Gillingham, because one of the classes said you have to use Orton-Gillingham. It has to be Orton-Gillingham based for it to work. And so that's really where I started understanding what things were doing. Yeah.
So then how did you make the transition from being a classroom teacher to becoming an educational therapist?
Well, I got a little burned out on teaching after I'd been at the charter school for 2 years. Then I went to one of the largest elementary schools in Oakland for a year and felt that the need was just so great there, including emotional needs and psychological needs. We had over 1,000 students and one psychologist for 2 days a week. She was split between two different Oakland schools. And everyone in my classroom had had someone who died. Some of them had people shot that year. Most of them were divorced. Some of them were dealing with domestic violence at home. I mean, there was just so much need. And eventually the psychologist said, stop referring your kids to me because I can't only see your children.
That's incredible. So, yeah. So what were some of the ways that that trauma was manifesting in your classroom that you could identify as a classroom teacher?
Yeah. Well, for instance, one of my students would have these meltdowns. This was second grade. He would just have meltdowns. He would be crawling on the floor sobbing, and I couldn't get him up off the floor. He would just be sobbing. And finally, I talked to his mom about how much sleep he was getting, and she thought she was doing the right thing. She said, I always make sure he's in bed by 10. Well, he was in second grade, so I was like, really? He needs to be in bed by 8. So that made his behavior get better. But then one day, he was a mess again. He was on the floor. And I said, did you get enough sleep last night? And he said, no. And I said, well, why not? And he said, well, because my sister was just getting out of jail. And my dad wanted us to stay up so that we could all greet her when she got home. And she didn't get home till after midnight. So I said, okay, go sleep in the library. We had a little classroom library. So that was one very obvious example.
Yeah.
There's one child who was so easily angered, and she just had no frustration tolerance, that one day I made all the kids mix their own colors because I had taken an art class that said you shouldn't have anything but primary colors and make them mix it. And she got so mad at me because she couldn't remember how to make green for her tree that she started spreading red paint everywhere. I mean, she put her hands into the red paint, she tipped over her desk, and she started trying to spread red paint everywhere. And this is a second grader. So I kind of dragged her with her two red hands up in the air to the principal's office. He at first thought she was bleeding and was actually very relieved that it was red paint. And then we, you know, he talked about her behavior and stuff. But then a couple days later, she was misbehaving again, and so I called her grandmother, who she lived with. And her grandmother said, will you tell her that if she doesn't get her act together, I'm going to come and whoop her in front of the whole class? And as soon as she said that, I realized maybe I was getting an insight into why she was angry all the time.
Absolutely.
And had no frustration.
Absolutely.
Tolerance.
And I see this actually play out a lot with different students, is that sometimes the ones that have the really short fuse are the ones that they're not getting a lot of support at home, or that they get in trouble very quickly and very severely for their challenges. So you really saw a lot of challenges when you were teaching there. So you're feeling burned out.
Yeah. So I actually took a year off and then went back to teaching at a small Jewish day school. And I like to say that I went from teaching underprivileged kids to overprivileged kids, because these kids had everything. And in some ways, it manifested in the same way. Like, nobody cleaned up after themselves. The underprivileged, you know, Oakland kids didn't, because they didn't really have a sense of ownership over anything and they didn't take responsibility for it. the kids at the Jewish day school often didn't do it because they felt like somebody else was being paid to do it. So it was almost like too much ownership. But of course, everybody still had, not everybody, but there was still dyslexia. There was still autism. There was still emotional issues. There were still divorces. And sometimes overly protective parents that could create the same type of stress or, you know, still a stress level.
Okay.
Or a lack of feeling of ownership of the work because they were so involved that they had almost taken over.
Whoops. Sorry about that, guys. It looks like we lost a little bit of audio. Let's get right back to the show. Anne-Marie is asking Diana for some of her very best tips for helping kids with emotional regulation. Here we go.
Okay, so I was asking, so what are some of the tools and resources and books that you use for students that have a hard time with the self-regulation piece?
It's interesting because I think there's always this tension, you know, you want to be doing real work, quote unquote, and you also want to be paying attention to these kids' needs, and you have to. And I think sometimes for the younger kids, they don't have direct access to what's upsetting them. And so sometimes you need to sort of do an end run. I had a student who was, he was finishing first grade, and he was a really kind of happy-go-lucky kid, always smiling. He came in one day and he said, I'm kind of sad, I don't know why. And I said, well, has anything happened? He said, no. And I said, you know, this is maybe one of those days where it's a good idea for you to dictate a story to me. You know, because who wants to decode nonsense words when you're sad and you don't know why. Now, I kind of thought, and that'll give you a chance to express why you're sad. I didn't need to say that to him. He was just like, cool, a story. So I actually have this setup that I really like. It's my computer is set up to a projector. The projector goes to a screen. And so if a kid dictates to me, they can watch their story be written. And so he wrote, dictated to me this just very cute, simple story about a little doggy who was sad. And he was sad because, he was normally always happy, but he was sad today because he missed his family. And I said, oh, well, that makes sense. I said, what, you know, most stories have a problem and a solution. And you've said the problem that this little doggy is sad because he misses his family. What might a solution be? And he said, maybe he asks the people if he can go home. And they say yes. And so I said, okay, well, how do you want to say that? And he said, he asked the people if he could go home. He told the people he was sad and could he go home? And they let him go home. And then he was happy. Now, I didn't go, wow, it's really interesting that you've written about the sad puppy. I wonder if that's you. I didn't have to belabor the point. I didn't even have to say, you know, I'm going to call your mom and you can go home. We just went on with the rest of our work, and he was okay once he had expressed it, even though he expressed it indirectly, and even though he may have been unaware that he expressed it indirectly.
You know, what I find really interesting with students is sometimes they come in, occasionally they come in so upset, you know, they're in tears or they're crying, and sometimes they actually need you to tell the story of what happened to them. Mm-hmm. And it's like once they can access that story, then they're able to get on with their lesson. And I had really similar student, really happy, jolly student, and he came in tears one day, and it turned out that he had gotten pulled early from camp, and he had missed the raffle, and the camp counselor had not been very kind about him missing the raffle, and he was very disappointed that he didn't get his prize. And so he was in my waiting room, and he was sobbing and crying. And so I said, let me see, you know, I can see you seem really sad and really frustrated and just angry that you're here working instead of playing. Let me see if I can tell the story. And I told the story. He stopped crying. He got up. He walked in. He sat down and he got started. It was just that he needed that validation and then he was ready to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you have your students create stories.
Right.
Sometimes we can tell the stories for them.
Yeah.
And then how else does storytelling play in for you?
Well, let's see. One time, I had a student who it was actually the same student from I was talking about before. She had just gotten her retainer, her very first retainer. She knew how expensive it was. Everybody had warned her not to lose it and to be very careful. That day, she put it in her lunch bag because she was going to have her snack walking home. and she was spinning her lunch bag around, and she didn't connect the fact that it might fall out of her lunch bag. So when she got home, she couldn't find it, and they went to search for it right before she came here, and her dad had just come in with the news that it had been smushed on the side of the street.
Oh, no.
As she came to my place. So we talked about it, and you know, I'm sure your parents understand that it's a mistake, and yes, I know you wanted to be the responsible child who doesn't lose this, but she just couldn't let go of it, and we tried. 5 minutes later, it was back. 5 minutes later, it was, you know, the thoughts were back, and I eventually said, I'm going to act like you're a little kid, and I'm going to read to you. So go sit on my pillows on the ground, and I'm going to read to you. And I pulled out Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. And I read her the entire book, and we talked about it, and I said, yes, you're having a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. And she agreed, and we laughed about it, and that was it. We had the rest of the 20 minutes worry-free, and she just needed to see that it was, you know, fit into a frame of universal
terrible days. That is so cool. Now, what about when you were in the classroom? And I know that was a real challenge for you when you had 20 or 30 other kids and you have the kid that's just falling apart. What do you do in that situation?
You know, there were some kids, I remember one who really did have trouble self-regulating. So I would ask her to step outside, and she knew that I wasn't punishing her. I'd say, I'll be there as soon as I can. Yeah. And as soon as I got everybody else calm and working and, you know, doing whatever, where I could step outside, right outside, so I could still hear if craziness erupted in the classroom, I would actually, I worked with her some in the way a friend of mine who was learning to be a therapist had told me, which is to really ground her in the present and almost a mindfulness activity. And it's a very easy activity. You just start listing colors for them to touch. So I'd say, okay, touch something red, touch something green, touch something blue. Oh, and first I would say, on a scale of 1 to 10, how upset are you? And then we would do this for 2 minutes until I could see that she had soothed herself. And then I'd say, on a scale of 1 to 10, how upset are you? And that sort of added the metacognitive piece, because she'd say, oh, I'm at a 3 now. And then we could talk about it, you know, and I always thought, well, we can't talk about it until she's calm. You know, trying to soothe it, trying to tell her that it's not that bad and she'll get over it. You know, by tomorrow she won't even know, remember that her friend did blah, blah, blah to her. Just, it doesn't help. It's invalidating, and she couldn't hear it, and it sounded dismissive. And so if I could calm her down, then we could start having conversations, and she could calm herself down.
Cool.
Which was good.
Makes sense. So a lot of the strategies you've talked to are really sort of driven by Diana. And they're sort of you working with the student, and you build a lot of connection and rapport. Are there any strategies that you teach the student how to start self-soothing themselves? How does that work for you?
You know, a lot of it has to do with this self-awareness. Right. And I do the scale of 1 to 10.
Right.
So especially in my classroom, because frankly, 1 to 1, they don't get super angry. You know, nothing makes you as angry as something that happened at recess. And so I'd say, on a scale of 1 to 10, how angry were you when you shoved him, threw the ball, broke the thing, whatever it was? And usually, you know, they'd say 10, or sometimes they'd say 100. And I'd say, did you notice yourself getting that angry? Did you ramp up, like first you were a 2, and then a 3, and then a 4, or did you just jump to 10? Now, if they just jump to 10, then we would talk about trying to start breathing or get out of the situation. But if they said they ramped up, we would decide on a number that once they're there, they need to get themselves out of the situation. And one student, I said, look, if you get yourself, you feel yourself at a 3 or a 4 and you know you're going up, you grab the hall pass and you walk out. You don't even need to tell me why. Just walk out. And a lot of times just getting out of the situation, walking the hall back and forth a couple times was enough to calm him down, where if he stayed in the situation, he would have gotten to 10 and tried to, you know, punch a kid or tried to knock a chair over.
So, tell us more.
Dyslexia getting stuck.
Exactly.
He was totally that
kid. Tell us more about what you know about, like, the brain and the amygdala and how that gets in the way of what happens when they're stuck. What's going on?
You know, that's interesting, because actually that's another thing that I talk about a lot with the kids to understand it, especially the ones who get anxious, like, before a test. So, and this is what I tell them. I say, look, there's a piece in your brain that decides where information goes. It's called the amygdala, and I show them where it is in the inside of their brain.
And how do you show students that?
Oh, well, I just sort of point between my... Let's see.
You use your own head.
I use my own head and point down from the middle and out, you know, and say, right here where these two fingers meet.
Okay.
Or I show them a picture of the brain. And I say, the amygdala's job is to decide whether information can go forward to your front brain, where you can do math and you can think and it's very calm, or you spell, or whether it goes to the back brain, which shuts down the front brain and says, we need to run, that's flight, we need to fight, that's fight, or we're going to freeze so that the scary thing doesn't see us. And I say, look, this was very useful when we used to have saber-toothed tigers running after us, because if a saber-toothed tiger is running after you, you don't want to say, my goodness, what should I do? You know, that saber-toothed tiger is a little bit bigger than the one that I saw the other day, and I wonder if I should... Can I outrun it, or should I run up a tree? And by then, you're going to be dead. So your brain just goes, forget thinking. You're either going to run, you're going to freeze, or you're going to fight this thing. Well, the amygdala can't actually tell the difference between a saber-toothed tiger and a math test. It thinks, oh my gosh, she's really scared. We need to either fight, flight, or freeze. And when you've done that, you're not going to be solving problems, which just freaks you out more. So I say, this is the thing, is that scientists have shown, and that's a very powerful phrase for kids, scientists have shown that 3 deep breaths can completely change your brain chemistry. Because you're not going to take 3 deep breaths if a saber-toothed tiger is running after you. So you take 3 deep breaths, and your amygdala goes, wow, we can't be in that much danger, or she wouldn't have time to breathe deeply. And so then it calms itself down, and you're back in the front of the brain where you can think and do math and spell or whatever it is that we're talking about.
That's fantastic. So do you do those 3 deep breaths with your students sometimes?
I try sometimes. A lot of times, the boys often don't want to do it because they feel self-conscious and silly. Sometimes girls will be able to do it with me.
Yeah.
But I feel like at least planting the seed there and telling them this is a strategy.
Right.
If they will, we'll practice. You know, I say, okay, put your hand on your belly and breathe into your hands.
Right.
I have a little card with, this is a friend of mine showed this to me, so I can't take credit for it, but a rose on one side and a flame on the other. And she said, now you look at the rose and you pretend that it smells amazing. So you take in this huge deep breath of the most amazingly smelling rose ever. And then you flip the card and you blow out the flame. And that visual, I think, helps some of the kids.
Again, that's fantastic.
With the rose, I think I don't try it with the boys.
That's interesting. I have the same problem with my students that they feel a little self-conscious with the deep breathing. And I've had a few students, and the one strategy that has worked well with some of my sillier kids is we talk about taking a really deep breath and then letting their whole face go slack as they breathe out. So it's like... and it can be pretty self-soothing for students. And I have a really funny story is one of my students and I, we worked on that for a time and then we moved on. And then she had a really stressful event the next day. And she was going to be touring her new middle school. Mm-hmm. And she was freaked out about going to this new middle school. And the mom called me the next day and she said, I had no idea what my daughter was doing because I heard these really funny sounds coming from the bedroom. And I walked in and my daughter said, oh, these breaths that Anne-Marie taught me really do work. So the breath. And I really love your that image of the rose and the flame. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Really cool.
And I think when they just know... that there are tools and they understand why they're panicking and why they can't do math when they're panicking or why they can't spell when they're panicking, it really helps. Because otherwise they go, well, but I knew this, I studied for it, now I'm stupid. Again, a lot of this comes to the kids thinking they're stupid. So if you can explain it
right,
in terms of evolutionary biology and saber-toothed tigers, they go, oh,
yeah, okay. And, like, it's a really good thing that your brain is designed to keep you safe from saber-toothed tigers. It's actually not designed to learn how to read.
Yeah.
Right? It's doing what it's supposed to.
Right.
Good job, brain.
Yeah. Cool. But this is a math test or, you know, a book, not a saber-toothed tiger.
Yeah. What other strategies do you use with your students?
You know, one thing that I did, it was kind of spontaneous. I'd used it in my classroom a lot as an opening day or opening week project. In the classroom, there are certain times that you know are going to be high stress. So I always tried to build in a lot of supportive emotional techniques during it. And one was at the beginning of the year, I always read the amazing children's book by Kevin Hankey called Wemberly Worried. And in this, Wemberly worries about everything, and her grandmother is always telling her she worries too much, and the other, her parents are telling her it's going to be fine, and but she worries about everything. And then she goes to preschool or kindergarten and finds a friend who is also very anxious and shy, and they bond over their names of the their stuffed animals that they brought. So I read that at the beginning of the school year. And I also read this fabulous poem by Shel Silverstein called What If, where he talks about the what ifs dancing in his head. And, you know, he thinks everything's going well, but then the what ifs come in and start worrying things. And the great thing about Shel Silverstein is half of them are incredibly silly. You know, what if green hair starts growing on my chest? And half of them are really serious. What if my parents get divorced? What if nobody likes me? And it sort of ties into the Wemberly Worried because there's a huge double-paged spread of her what-ifs about school. And it says, what if, you know, and for hers, it's what if I can't find the bathroom? And again, what if nobody likes me? And so I always use that at the beginning of school. But one day I had a little girl come in and she pulled her mom down at the beginning of the session and whispered something to her. And her mom said, oh, my child wants you to know that she's worried because tomorrow she has a sleepaway camp for the very first time. And she's never slept at a sleepaway camp. She's never slept outside of our house, you know, or alone, not with a parent. And is there anything you can do about it? So I thought, okay, I can do this. So I pulled out Wemberly Worried and we read that and we talked about the what ifs and then we read the what if poem by Shel Silverstein. And then I pulled out the sheet that I had made for my school, which is just a picture frame with four or five lines underneath it for writing. And it says, what if? And I said, okay, I want you to write your what if here. And so she did a fabulous drawing. It was so awesome. Of her, it was in her sleeping bag next to the tent, and the sleeping bag wouldn't zip, and it started to rain, and a bear attacked. Those were her big things. What if I can't zip my sleeping bag? What if it rains and I get all wet? And what if a bear attacks me? So we did that. She wrote it out, and so, you know, I could say, hey, we're working on literacy, she's writing, we've read, we're integrating it, we're doing comprehension, we're doing visualizing of it. And then we said, okay, well, what would you do? And she said, well, I would ask the counselor to help me with the sleeping bag, and I would go into somebody's tent. And then you don't get wet in a tent, which I told her. I don't know that she knew that you didn't get wet inside a tent. And what was her solution for the bear? It was so cute. I think she said she would throw all of her food at the bear to scare it away. So she was fine. You know, she had expressed her deepest, darkest fears. She had worked her way through them imaginatively with some pretty, you know, good solutions. I think throwing your cans of food at a bear is a pretty good solution. And she just felt much better. And then afterwards we could say, you know, gosh, you had these fears and you went to camp. What did you think? What happened? Nothing. It was fun. It was fabulous. I said, wow, so all that worry and nothing happened? You still liked it? And I think that's really good to tie back in.
I think that's really interesting. So you like to circle back mm-hmm. to what the student's concern was and help them process that.
Right. Yeah. And I'll even say very explicitly, the next time you're worried, I want you to remember that you were very worried about this and you had a great time. Because we're really building resilience in the kids, which the brain science shows you can do.
Diana, we have a very similar approach, I think. Yeah. Really similar. I was just talking about this with a student the other day because this was the student that's feeling so challenged in speech language therapy because it's so hard and it's just drilling in on his really severe weaknesses. And he was crying and upset. And I said, how did it go? He said, oh, it was fine. And I was like, well, that is so cool that you figured out, because it took me, I don't know, way more decades than you've ever been alive to figure out that, like, most of the time when I worry about something, what ends up happening is way, way better than anything I could have ever imagined.
Oh, yeah. I used to do that in my classroom. I had a composition book, and kids were allowed to write problems in there. The rules were they had to state it in an iMessage, they weren't allowed to call names, and they had to have already tried to solve their problem with a friend. And then on Fridays, we would have a big community meeting and go through the stuff in the book and brainstorm ways to solve these problems. And I would say 3/4 of the time, I would say, okay, child, on Monday, your friend pushed you or wouldn't share the football with you, or, you know, you thought they cheated in soccer. Are you guys still having conflict? And they would say, no. Or they'd say, what? And every time that happened, I'd say, I just want to point out again that sometimes we are so angry at our friends and we think we're never going to be friends again. And then see by Friday, you guys are not only friends, you just forgot what you had written and you were laughing about it. And then if there were problems, we could talk about them. But every time that they got solved easily, I would point it out. Because especially, these were third graders, if you're angry at your friend, right at that moment, that is the end of the world. You are angry at them. They will never become your friend again. It's just terrible. And having it pointed out multiple times in a neutral way.
Right.
After the fact.
Right.
I think can really give them perspective. At the time, useless. At the time, saying, oh, you know, by tomorrow you won't remember it, just minimizes their
right
concerns.
And who, you know, you wouldn't want to come home from work one day and tell your husband about something that had happened and he brush it off and, oh, you won't even be thinking about this tomorrow. Like, you'd want to sock him.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That wouldn't fly.
Oh, and I remember in high school
having
my first terrible breakup. You know, of course it was terrible. We had been dating, I think, 3 whole months. And one of my teachers said, by the time you're 20, you won't even remember his name. And I thought, that teacher doesn't know me, and she doesn't know the depths of my relationship, and she doesn't know how important this was and how amazing this boy was. And I still know his name, but of course I did get over it. But at the time, I just thought that it showed that she was really dumb and really unconnected to me. And I don't want a student to feel like I really don't get them. Right. And even if it's true, and I know it's true, telling them that is just going to feel like I'm another stupid grown-up.
Right. So would you say that a lot of the challenges, that when students come in and they're stressed and they're feeling anxious or worried, are a lot of those stressors for your students socially related? Or a good good portion of them?
I would say it depends on the kid, but yeah, most of them I think are socially related. Some of them are teacher related. And I have to say, I love teachers. I was a teacher. I know teachers try their very best. There are some times where I want to go and slap a teacher. I had a student who had a complex set of issues. She had trouble with auditory processing and visual processing. And what the testing found was it was much worse when the two were asked to go together. And her third grade teacher was teaching multiplication facts, as all third grade teachers do, and had figured out this way to do one test for all the kids, no matter which fact family they were on, where they would draw a column of five columns on their paper with 10 cells in each column, and they were supposed to write the five numbers that they were working on there. So if you were working on your twos, threes, fives, and sixes, you would have that at the top of the column. And then all she would do was call out numbers to multiply it by. So she would say, first column times 3, first column times 5, first column times 7. And this was confusing. I think I would be confused. I would have trouble following this.
And you have to keep pace with the teacher, too.
And you have to keep pace with the teacher, which means you don't have any time to process. And
all of your classmates, too.
And all of your classmates.
Oh, my gosh. The person next to me has got it done already.
Right. And it was very visual and very auditory together, which was her exact weakness. And when she said, can you say what you just said to the teacher would say, leave it blank and move on. And this girl also had huge anxiety. Well, as soon as the teacher said, leave it blank and move on, her anxiety, again, saber-tooth tiger, her brain shut down. And so she would flunk the rest of the test. And her mom was saying, look, I can see these tests. She studies and studies and studies at home, and she does fine until she misses one, and she doesn't get any others right. And so she was really fighting. I mean, there could not have been a test created to tap her weaknesses more. And the teacher kept telling her, you just need to study more. And it was that moment that I wanted to go, you know, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, find this teacher and just slap them. Because to tell a student who is working so hard, 10 times harder than any of her peers, that she's not working hard enough, when the test is designed, obviously not purposefully, but the test is going exactly to her weakness and not at all designed for her to show her strengths, it just was adding insult to injury. And that created a lot of stress.
So that's really interesting, as we've been talking a lot about some of the common challenges our students face, and I think one of them can be flexibility. And I feel like you're coming up to how adults, including ourselves, can be inflexible at times, and then that really creates a lot of conflict with our students. So, you know, it sounds like having, you know, sometimes we get really fixated on the type of test would we want to administer, and we don't want to change that. What are some other areas where you see that we could all work on being a little bit more flexible in our thinking as educators?
You know, there are a lot. I would say one of the biggest ones, and this, it's funny because of all the blog posts I've ever written, this has been the most popular, the most commented on, the most shared. I mean, it went viral in its own little educational therapist blog kind of way, is asking students to show their work in math. And for the most part, great idea. It's cool. And it's really a sacred cow. Everybody wants to do it because that's what good math teachers do. And if you want to make sure that they understand the process, you have them show their work. And just practically, if you want to be able to find their mistakes, you have them show their work. Well, there are certain kids for whom showing their work is like asking them to sit down and have their teeth pulled. For the most part, these are the ADD kids who really, they don't think sequentially. They can make brilliant leaps of logic, including working out algebraic formulas in their head. And if you ask them to write it out, sometimes they don't remember what they were thinking, and sometimes they just don't have the patience, or their brain doesn't have the capability to stay focused on the minutiae. And it's just painful. And the other group of kids who hate this, on the other side of the spectrum, are some kids with autism, who tend to process visually and through pattern recognition and have trouble making connections between their words and their pictures. And they may solve a math problem visually and through pattern recognition and not know the words to describe what they did. And to ask them to show their work is really saying, I don't value what you do have and how what your strengths are here, and I need you to show it to me in my way, based on my learning and my understanding of learning. And it's asking them, again, to demonstrate their weaknesses. And I think it's not that I'm against asking kids to show their work, but what I'm against is the inflexibility of teachers who can't say, well, what is this student's issue? Now, if they're just your average 11-year-old who goes, oh, but that's boring, well, fine. Say it's worth credit. No problem. I have no problem with that. But if they're really struggling with it, then you need to be, I believe, flexible enough to bend and say, okay, well, you know, for the ADD kids, show your work once, and as long as your math is accurate, you don't have to show the rest of the work.
That makes sense. You know, it's so interesting, as I read your blog post, and I was working with a student on a problem of the week, and he has dyslexia, and he's really good at seeing patterns and sort of thinking big picture. And he is also an extremely fast processor. His processing speed comes in around like a standard score of 130. So
oh my gosh,
really, really fast. And what was funny is that we were working together and I felt uncomfortable actually because he could do some of the math steps faster than I could.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting to see that sort of like discomfort that brought for me and how then I wanted to control the steps and the process that he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like, I needed to be able to be aware that like, ooh, this feels icky for me, but you know what? He's doing really well. So I just need to kind of name that discomfort and then just keep working with him. And that was a really helpful tool for me.
Oh yeah. I think being aware when it's your own stuff
versus
the kids' stuff is just super, super,
which
super
is so
important.
Funny because we've been talking about helping kids name what's going on for them, like to name it, to tame it. And so often for us, it's the exact same thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I know
and
teachers,
we need our empathy for ourselves, too.
Right.
You're like, oh, this is really frustrating right now.
Yeah. It's true. And I know teachers who every time they feel bad, they blame it on the kid as if the kid is doing it on purpose.
Right.
And I think it's super important to be clear when it's your own stuff being triggered and when it's the student. And if I were queen of the world, I would mandate that all teachers go to therapy, at least to talk about teaching, because you really need help sometimes, you know, especially if you're really triggered, you need help to disentangle what's you and what's the kid.
Right. And then you're so isolated in the classroom too.
Right. And it's so easy to get into this us versus them, these kids are out to get me, and for the most part, no, they're not.
Yeah.
They don't think of you as fully human, so they might be thoughtless, but who of us thought of our teachers as fully human? I mean, did you have any teachers that you thought of going to the bathroom?
Right, it was just shocking when you discovered them at the grocery store.
Right, like, you exist? What? You know, much less, you had a traumatic childhood and therefore what I said reminded you of something and now you're upset. I mean, forget about it. They don't have the capacity to do that. And you need to have the capacity to say, you know what, this has nothing to do with my kid or my students. This has to do with me.
Yeah.
And I had one colleague who came to me once livid because she said there was a fourth grade student who happened to be on the Asperger's spectrum, or on the autism spectrum, we would call it now. So he was socially awkward, and he was really bright, and his way of getting people to like him was to show off how much he knew, because that's what he got, that's what made sense to him. So she had been telling this story in class and talking about her interpretation of it, and he raised his hand and said, no, it means blah, 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 blah. And she came in and livid. That student tried to make me look stupid in front of the class. He challenged my authority. He wanted to show me up. He wanted to all of these things. Now, this fourth grader adored her and was socially awkward and was a fourth grader and had no intention to do any of those evil, awful things. What he wanted to do was show her how much he knew so that she liked him. And she completely misinterpreted it based on how bad it made her feel. She then thought that was his intention.
Right.
And really, she needed to be able to hold the bad feelings like you were. You know, this is making me uncomfortable that a student is better at math than I am or faster at math.
Faster, yes.
Right. faster at math, and it makes me uncomfortable, and I don't like it, but you know what? That's my stuff, yeah. And that's not his stuff or her stuff.
Yeah. Well, now that's an interesting one, too, like the when a student is doing something faster or at a different level and feeling uncomfortable about that. I feel like that happens to our students a lot, too. When, especially for our students, that they don't complete tasks as quickly as their peers, and that's a big source of stress for them. And like, the student next to me is reading Harry Potter, and I'm reading this little book. Any ways that you help students deal with those challenges?
You know, that's a really hard one. And I say, I think it's a long-term investment in breaking down those beliefs. And I always tell parents this. There are three things little children think of as making you smart. How fast you read, how well you spell, and how many of your math facts you have memorized. And you can lecture and show videos and talk till you're blue in the face about multiple intelligences. You can have everybody take quizzes and you can have everybody learn about it. But for the most part, little kids feel like it's all about reading, spelling, and math facts. And so it's just a long-term breaking that down, talking about different people's different strengths, how speed has nothing to do with math in general. The only time it does is in third grade with those stupid timed math tests, which probably people should not use, in my humble opinion. And how spelling, you know, there are a lot of people who don't spell, you know, and that's when I pull out a lot of the people who are famous, you know, Albert Einstein, the most famous mathematician ever, the most famous scientist ever, hated arithmetic. Probably had autism, we don't know for sure, but probably had autism, didn't speak until he was 3, and thought visually and hated arithmetic. And revolutionized the world as we know it, or revolutionized how we know the world. Leonardo da Vinci, you know, who intuited the helicopter, couldn't spell to save his life. You know, so going through those lists of people who have succeeded. Also, one of the things I think is really, really important is naming the disability.
And that's exactly what I was going to say, because I think you need to be able to name the disability in order to make connections.
Absolutely. And, you know, I always like playing with etymology because I'm a word nerd. And defining something means making it not infinite. It means bounding it. And can't see me, but I always, to talk to parents, show a big, huge arm wide above my head. Students think they're stupid and they think it's this big, you know, as wide as the world. And if you can say it's this small piece in your brain that it has glitches in it called dyslexia, or it's this small thing about connections, you know, and that's what autism is, it defines it, it bounds it, and it makes it not infinite. It changes it from I'm stupid to, oh, I have this challenge. And I had a student, actually the one with the anger management issues, who clearly had dyslexia, and he had skated by because he was super smart. He had gotten remediation in first and second grade and then didn't for third and fourth, and I had him in fifth and went, whoa, he needs help. And his dad came to me and said, you know, we're on board, this is great, but you need to talk to him, because he came to us and said, why does everybody think I'm stupid all of a sudden? So I said, you know, student, I need to talk to you. And I said, look, you are this smart. And I held my hand way up as far as I could and showed, you know, like a temperature. You're this smart. And you're reading at this level, and held my other hand up at eye level. And I said, if you were dumb, we wouldn't be worried about you. We'd think, oh, poor student is working up to his capacity and just is never going to be able to read very well. But you're not. You're really smart. So there's a really big gap between what we think you should be able to do and what you can do. And again, I did the brain thing. It's not about intelligence. It's about this little piece that's not working in your brain. And it's the dyslexia. And this is the good news, is it can be fixed or at least helped. And that's why you're going to this amazing educational therapist named Joanne Shapiro down in the peninsula. And he nodded at me, very black and white thinker. He nodded at me and said, oh, okay. And he was fine. So by eighth grade, when he took the big standardized test to get into high schools and was in the 95th, 96th, 97th percentile on everything but reading conventions and was down in the low 85th percentile, he was able to ball up his fist and go, darned conventions! And that was it. And I have to say, very proudly, not that this has to do all with me, but he is at Cal now, which was his hope forever and ever, and was running for student body council. And, you know, he's just been incredibly successful. And he knows he has dyslexia, and he knows it's best for him to listen to books on tape. And he knows he's terrible at spelling and conventions. And that's it. And he knows how smart he is.
That's such a good story.
Oh my God, he was so funny.
That's such a good story. I love your idea of that it's, we're going to have to create a visual, that it's infinite until it's defined, and then when it's defined. And I also really like your language with glitch, too. Yeah. I think that's a Pam Scribner there.
Yeah, probably.
I really like the glitch. Okay, so tell us, what are some of the common stressors that your students face at school?
Well, all students, whether they're neurotypical, whether they're learning disabled, whatever, there are a couple things you just know as a teacher or as someone working with kids they're going to face. And one is the beginning of school. It creates enormous amount of anxiety. So I always make sure when I was a classroom teacher, we had a whole unit on it, which I had talked about What If. And there are a ton of cool children's books that I like to use, Wemberly Worried, Timothy Goes to School, Lily's Purple Plastic Purse. A lot of Kevin Hanke books are fabulous for it. And so we always talked about it a lot and really just brought it up. I shared that I was always nervous at school, which I learned from my master teacher, who was in her 30th year teaching and still shared that she was always nervous the night before school and that she was worried that the students wouldn't like her. And so just really bringing it out in the open, what are you guys worried about, you know, and just having it talked about so that they felt like it was held. And the other thing, and a lot of people don't think about this because it hides, is the end of the school year. And it hides in everybody's excitement for summer because everybody's super excited for summer and everybody wants summer to come. But I think what a lot of times people forget is that the end of the school year is a big ending. And it's the dissolution of a big community that you've spent all your building and the known and moving into the unknown. Summer can actually be really stressful because you're not with all your friends all the time. You have to plan socialization. You don't just have recess to go do stuff. You're not surrounded by your friends. There's a lot of free time, which for some kids is fabulous and for some kids gets really stressful. And there might be camps and all sorts of things. So that's really something to pay attention to. And I always, as a classroom teacher, made sure to talk a lot towards the end of the school year about how hard it is to let go of friends. And I also talked about some of the research that shows, this is psychological research, that shows that when people who love each other are about to separate, I think a lot of this research happened during the Iraq War, it's very common for them to fight because it's easier to separate from someone you're angry at than from someone you are feeling very lovey-dovey about. And so people have noticed this during the Iraq War, they had noticed that a lot of times the wives of people won't come to see them off because it's too painful. And so they'll just say bye beforehand. And a lot of times there's a lot of little bickering, not like huge fights, but a lot of bickering. And a lot of families feel like, oh my gosh, what's wrong with me? I'm not going to see my husband for 9 months. And here I've spent the last 3 days complaining about whatever, the toilet seat being up. And then these psychologists help them to realize that that's because it makes the transition easier. Well, the same thing happens in a classroom. You know, you'll have all these rules and all these relationships and everything's going smoothly until right about May. And all of a sudden, things start falling apart, and you really don't know why, and a lot of teachers will say, oh, it's just spring fever, it's just because it's nice outside. But what I found was if you sit there, again, and talk about it, name it, as you were saying, I always talked about the studies that they did with the Iraq War, and really bring it out there, that it'll calm things down, because again, it explains these feelings to the kids, and it makes it out in the open, so it doesn't have to simmer underneath. And I also did, when I was a classroom teacher, a lot of work talking about what we appreciated about each other, what we were going to miss, what we looked forward to. I think one of my best spontaneous meeting topics was I had the students look around, think about, it was children going from 5th grade into middle school. And some of them were staying and some of them were leaving. But for everybody, it was a huge transition. And they were getting very bickery. And so everybody in this had to think about one of the challenges they were worried about for the next year. And for some of them, it was, you know, having a locker. For some of them, it was transitioning from classroom to classroom. You know, a lot of things change in middle school. And then they needed to think about who in the classroom had a capacity to deal with that kind of thing. And so when we went around, the sort of framing was, for instance, say, Anne-Marie, I really appreciate how thoughtful you are with your students, and I hope that I can bring that with me next year, because I'm worried about making friends. And I think if I can bring your thoughtfulness to next year, it's going to help me. And it sounds kind of corny, but it turned into a very profound experience. And I think the kids really appreciated the appreciation they got from other kids. And they really got a sense that they could deal with the issues that were scaring them. So it really kind of hit a whole bunch
That's really cool. And it also frames, like, strength as something that you could share and they could amplify. So it's not that somebody's really good at something, so therefore I'm not, but maybe it's something that I could grow from. That's really neat.
Yeah, it worked really well. And it was great. You know, if I can remember you laugh at everything, if I can remember to laugh at things, then I won't be as upset. You know, things like that. And it really, and that's how we grow, is we do appreciate other people, and there are heroes, and, you know, maybe in a small way or just for one way, and we try to emulate them. And yeah, it worked really well.
Well, fantastic. That's great. Well, I hope I can bring your empathy and sort of playful spirit into my office tomorrow and be a better educational therapist.
Thank you.
So thanks for talking with us today, Diana.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Hey, everybody. I hope that you enjoyed that episode as much as I did. I know I'm going to be putting some of these tools to use right away in my music studio, and I can't wait to go try some of these tools. If you have a moment, please hop over to iTunes and let us know what you thought of the show. We read every single comment and every single review that we get, and it's so important to us to know what you guys think, because we make this show for you guys. You can also hop over to our website, baytreeblog.com, for lots of teacher tips and strategies, and also the show notes. If you go to baytreeblog.com/podcast, you'll find all of our podcast episodes there, including this one, episode 2. Thank you guys so much, and we will see you next time on The Exceptional Educator.